The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.
Just a warning, you may find our next interview a bit disturbing. Incredibly, a law has just been passed in Tennessee allowing teachers to carry concealed weapons on school grounds. Now, this is 25 years after the name Columbine became a byword for mass school shootings. On the 20th of April 1999, two high school students murdered 12 fellow students and one teacher at Columbine High School in Colorado. Luckily, their homemade bombs did not detonate. One of the officers who was part of the SWAT team which entered the building that day was A.J. DeAndrea, and the event shaped the rest of his career. A.J. joins us now. Good morning, A.J.
Good morning, sir. An honor to be here.
The name Columbine is etched on many people's minds, but for our listeners, perhaps they've forgotten what happened on that day 25 years ago. Can you remind us of how serious an incident this was at Columbine?
The tragedy actually would have been a lot worse. But basically, the gist of what took place is you had two school kids planned for over a year. And on April 20th, they attacked the school. While they were there at the school, 13 beautiful souls were taken from us. It caught... I feel comfortable saying this. It caught the entire American law enforcement, and that's from coast to coast, off guard. It wasn't by far the first school shooting or the big first school massacre by any means, but it caught everyone off guard and became the watershed moment for how law enforcement, communities, fire, EMS, how everyone changed how we conducted business. And it changed. We lost our innocence that day.
Now, you were in the SWAT team that went in. What did you find when you entered the complex, the school complex, which was a big enough school? What did you see?
So to put it in context, the school was 250,000 square feet. So it's a very big school. There was 1,945 students enrolled at that time. And so I didn't know what we were going to. It was kind of a bizarre thing. Dispatch told us that there was a man with a gun, shot fired. And so we had no idea of the enormity that we were going to step into. And so as we approached the school to make our entry, we were briefed by a Denver Metro SWAT guy. So I was with Jefferson County Regional SWAT at the time. I was with Arvada PD, which is a suburb of Denver. And that was our jurisdiction. But we're briefed by a Denver sergeant who said there were six gunmen inside the building barricading, taking hostages. Initial reports were eight. The first team that actually made entry on the east side were told eight. And so things changed really quick, right, from what we were initially told to what we had. And as we moved to our breach point, the first indication that I had that someone had been injured was Rachel Scott. She was laying there in the grass, and she was deceased. She'd been shot and killed. And that was the first moment that I knew a child had been hit. It was a monumental failure, if you could, in communication. And I don't blame anyone, and nobody blames anyone. It's just that information was never shared. And so we moved to our breach point, and I'm not going to go every move with you, but just to kind of set the tone, we moved to the breach point, and I was actually the breacher. That was my initial assignment that day. The breacher's the guy that, you know, knocks the door down or whatever to get people inside. I looked back as we're getting set to make entry because we ended up going through a window, which wasn't my job. So I'm kind of scanning the parking lot, right, to make sure that we're not going to get ambushed or anything happen. And there's a young man laying shot dead on the sidewalk. And so now I know, right, there's two children down. And so if you can just imagine, I mean, for your listeners, we finally make entry inside. It was absolutely deafening. The fire alarm was going off and the school bell was going off. And in 1999, they had no way to turn those things off. And it was a wet environment because the gunmen, and I won't say their names, there used to be a really good push in the United States where we would never say the shooters' names. And we've fallen off that here in the last few years, but I still believe it's healthier not to say their names than to say it. But they had tried to blow up the school. Their initial intent was blow up the cafeteria during lunch as people flee the building, shoot and kill anyone fleeing the building. They were positioned initially in the parking lot by their vehicles. When the cops came into the parking lot, they wanted to kill as many cops as they could and then die in a gunfight with the cops, kill themselves or flee. But inside their vehicles were 80 pounds total. So 40 pounds in each vehicle, high explosive to blow up and kill the first responders that were attending to the fires and the injured and all of that. So that was their plan. When their timing devices failed, they go into the school. They start shooting kids on the outside. They get into the school. They move around the school for a little bit of time, end up in the cafeteria to figure out, they're trying to see why their bombs didn't go off. And they were able to ignite a small one, which caused a huge ball of flames. And this is, of course, before we were in there. But this is going back to the statement, it was a wet environment because the fire suppression system turned on. So when we climb in, not only is it deafening, but there's, you know, about 8 inches of water on the floor. And actually, when I get into the auditorium and into the orchestra pit, water was hip deep. But we start to clear the building, deafening, start to get children out, get into the cafeteria because we breached into a room that was just off of that, where we made our entry. And we see the large one of, we didn't know there was two, or at least I didn't until much later, but saw one of the large explosive devices that they had set in there, which again now changes everything as well. It was at that moment, probably one of the moments that I don't know if proud is the right word, but sir, I have 6 Medal of Valors, so I've been through a lot in my life. But the moment that hangs with me as one of the proudest was at that moment. Our team leader at the time was a man named Barry Williams. He was an amazing man. But he looked at me, and I only had 3 years on the team at that point. But he looked at me, and he's like, AJ, I want you to take a team through the center part of the building. You get into the auditorium, deal with whatever's there. Get upstairs when you can, and you know, I'll see you tonight for a beer. And so I broke off at that point with 4 other men. And we began to clear the center part of the building. That little team of mine, we got 189 folks out, eventually find our way into the music room where I was tasked with a really hard decision. I had 60 kids that I had found inside a closet. And, you know, this is the trials and tribulations and the decisions that, you know, American law enforcement and law enforcement officers across the world, they have to make, right? They have to make decisions at the drop of a dime. And so I've got these 60 kids, and all of a sudden I hear from one of our snipers who's positioned outside that there's a sign in the window of one bleeding to death. And that was close to my location. And so you got to make a decision. Do you leave the 60, try to go find the one? Do you get the 60 out? You know, there's decisions to be made, and I don't need the... I live with my decisions every day. But I didn't know if the one bleeding to death was real. Was it a ruse? Was it, were we getting set up for an ambush? You know, what was going on? So I chose to get the 60 out. And I the 4 men that were with me, I broke them up into groups of 10. The children into groups of 10. I put the 4 men in what we call a diamond formation. Someone in the front, the back, and on each side. And I told them to get the 10 out. And told them to come back, you know, quick as you could, please. And I stayed with the 60 and told myself that if any of those 6 gunmen, at the time still believed it was 6, showed up, they'd have to kill me to get to those kids. So they come back, I give them 10, they come back, I give them 10, they come back, they give them 10. And I'm not going to go over everything, but just to kind of understand the turmoil in the decision-making, right? So finally, when we're getting the last 10 out, another element, another team, another SWAT team able to get to this area where one was bleeding to death. And that happened actually to be teacher Dave Sanders. So it was real, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, you live with those decisions. And so, you know, you ask the parents of the 60, did AJ do the right thing? And they're like, yeah, you know, thank you. You brought my child home to me. You ask the family of, you know, Dave Sanders, did AJ do the right thing? No. And I was sued actually 15 times at Columbine. Civilly 14 disappeared right away, but that lawsuit went on for quite some time with the Sanders family over that response. And I hold no malice or you know, anything towards that family. I get it. But it's just an example, right, of decisions that our law enforcement officers make. Eventually make it to the library, and it was an ungodly scene. That's where the majority of the individuals were shot and killed. You're moving in there. We actually found a few individuals that were alive. There was a young girl that was injured. A group of guys, not myself, but provided first aid to her, got her out. She survived. But in my 30 years in law enforcement, 16 years on SWAT, been involved in a lot of things, been involved in 3 school shootings, actually. That scene was the most horrific that I'd ever seen. And that's where we found the gunman. Another individual found the gunman, but I was the one closest, confirmed it. But yeah, so.
You mentioned at the very beginning that law enforcement right across America was ambushed by this. This was the loss of innocence. You know, there had been school shootings before, but this was at a level which could have been, you know, a multiple of the casualties that were actually inflicted on the day. What did that wake-up call do for school security?
So that was the watershed moment. Like you said, there were school shootings beforehand. I think this one became such an exclamation point, if you will, is because it happened. It was broadcast over the media from the time it started till the time it was done. I think it was the first one in our country where that actually took place. It was on national news, local news. And so it was a rallying cry of, you know, I can say that law enforcement, we probably weren't being visionary enough to understand the future dilemmas that were coming our way. I could actually probably say that about today as well, as scary as that sounds. But school shootings had happened, but no one was paying attention. So Columbine made us sit down and reevaluate everything that we were doing. Columbine was treated as a SWAT call out, right? So the normal patrol officer got there. There was actually a lot of exchange of gunfire between the suspects and the first deputies and patrol officers that got there. But they waited for the SWAT teams to get there. And we realized quickly that that could not happen. We couldn't do that anymore. And so a huge rallying cry. And by August of 1999, so by the next school year, at least in the Denver metro area, Jefferson County, Arvada, where I worked, we had patrol officers starting to train, and for the most part, mostly all trained up on new tactics of, listen, you can't wait for SWAT. We have got to formulate a team, get inside that building, and address the threat. And so then that changes this move that really for the rest of my career I was involved in, from refining those tactics to understanding it doesn't have to be four. It'd be better if it was 4 officers going in, right? Mm-hmm. But refining that, understanding the law enforcement, we've got three main things we do in an active shooting: stop the killing, stop the dying, start the healing. Then our fire departments start to get involved. So now we have what we call rescue task force, where we can have officers in there trying to address the threat, but then we escort firefighters in under police protection to get to the wounded. So we start to save lives faster, bring them outside to our paramedics and EMS for mechanized shuttle to get them to an emergency room to be able to save lives. And you've got the school districts that have totally changed the way that they conduct business as well. We have, believe it or not, we have lockdown drills. And some people get, you know, concerned about that. But, you know, we've been doing fire drills since the beginning of time. Fire is a threat, but I don't think in the United States we've lost a school to fire in over 50 years. Active shooting, unfortunately, is a real threat. Instead of letting it paralyze us, we prepare. And our students practice at least once or twice a year a lockdown drill. In most jurisdictions, it's not all the way across the country, but in most, especially here in the Denver metro area. And so they understand what to do in an emergency, and our educators understand what to do in an emergency.
So you have helped develop all of these protocols, which means that hopefully fewer people will be killed or injured by any shooter who gains access. But there's a bizarre element to this, and that is that your own daughter was caught up in a shooting in which people died, but the very protocols that you helped develop may have saved her life.
I wish I could take credit for all of it, right? But I'll tell you, I've got done a lot of heavy lifting, moved mountains with my bare hands. But the protocols that we instilled, so it's gone full circle, being at Columbine, pushing out the tactics. And then in 2018, in the Borderline Bar and Grill in Thousand Oaks, California, my oldest daughter, who was working at UCLA at the time, is subject to an active shooter. A gunman comes into the bar, begins to shoot. And the things that we had developed on the law enforcement side are going to help save her lives. The conversations that I had with my daughter, empowering her, letting her understand you don't have to be a victim. There's things that you can do to keep yourself alive. Empowered her to help her keep from being a victim. And she is able to, when the gunman gets into the building, she's able to maneuver herself into the kitchen area where she follows a bartender who had climbed up a ladder into the attic. And once she gets positioned in there, she sends me a text. And there's a couple stories in between. My second school shooting was in Platte Canyon High School, and the little girl, that's more of a hostage situation. Gunman goes in, he shoots, he holds seven girls hostages, he rapes them, sexually assaults them, and ends up holding on to two. End up becoming friends with the family of that little girl who's eventually killed. But there's a text string that takes place between her and her father. And he, you know, texts her, "Are you okay?" And she replies, "I love you guys." So for my family, that became a key text. If anyone was ever in trouble and there's nothing else you can do, you send that text. Well, I'm lying in bed. It's you know, a little bit after midnight in Colorado. And I get the text over my phone, "I love you guys." And at that moment, knew that there was something terrible going on. And was able to get on the frequency for Ventura County, their dispatch, their law enforcement dispatch. Was listening to that. I was texting my daughter what the law enforcement officers were doing because I could hear it, right? I got on the phone with Ventura County's dispatchers and said, "Hey, don't hang up on me. This is who I am. My daughter's in the attic," right? And they were wonderful. They kept me on the phone. So when my daughter would text me what she was hearing, I would give that to the dispatchers. And you pray with all you got. Because when you're there on scene and you get to make decisions, there's a little bit of, you're involved, you're making decisions, you're empowered a little bit. When you're sitting back and it's one of your own and there's nothing you can do, you feel helpless. And I'm just, you know, praying. I hope these guys are trained up. I hope all the hard work we did over the years, that these men and women are ready to go. And they were.
And they were.
And unfortunately, let me just finish with this. Unfortunately, because it's important to me, Sergeant Helis with Ventura County, he was shot and killed in the attempt to not only rescue my daughter, but everyone else in that room or in that bar. And, you know, there's nothing more you wish is to be able to look that man in the eye and shake his hand and say thank you. But that's the gravity of it. No.
Finally, AJ, I should ask you about prevention rather than response. I mean, is there anything that's better now about trying to spot the people who are likely to mount these kind of attacks?
Absolutely. And that is where the momentum is really in this country. We talk about eight pillars that we concentrate on. First is climate and culture. Second is threat assessment. And that is actually paying attention, deliberately paying attention to what people are saying and what their actions are. In the state of Colorado, we've stopped close to 29. It actually might be more than that at this point. Active shooter attempts where individuals had the means, the weaponry, and through programs like Safe to Text, Safe to Tell, that are anonymous, you have people saying, "Listen, you know, this individual isn't acting right." Getting them in front of the right people, whether that's law enforcement, a psychiatrist, psychologist, school counselor, diving into what's taking place. And there's rules that we can do. The First Amendment, people can say all kinds of crazy things in this country. But there are lines that can't be crossed. And it's those grassroots efforts, the hot button topics, if we could stay away from them, that divide our country. And those are the big political speaking points, right? Where we scream mental health, or we scream gun control, we scream all these other things. If we get away from those and we pay attention to the grassroots efforts of people that are in the community actually doing things, paying attention, we can stop these. And the threat assessment programs that have grown across this country, and really the gold standard is right here in Jefferson County. A man by the name of Dr. John Nicoletti kind of spearheaded a lot of these. We can stop these things. And there's been a lot of movement in that area.
Well, it's grimly fascinating and horrifying, I suppose, to us where, you know, there are no guns except those that hunters have, but normal firearms are not in the possession of ordinary people. We find it extraordinary, but there's a lot of tradition about gun ownership in the United States, and we understand all of that. But AJ De Andrea, former Columbine police officer, one of the first responders as a member of a SWAT team at the scene, thank you very much for joining us 25 years on from the Columbine tragedy.
Thank you so much, sir. It's been an absolute honor.
And if you were affected by anything in the interview, you can contact the Samaritans on 116123 or the Dublin Rape Crisis Centre National 24-Hour Helpline, 1-800-77-8888.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.